This podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Music Venue Trust. The Music Venue Trust is a UK registered charity which acts to protect, secure and improve grassroots music venues. The Music Venue Trust works to gain recognition of the essential role these venues fulfil, not only for artist development, but also for the cultural and music industries, the economy and local communities. They aim to preserve and improve venues, making them more efficient and improving the experience of performers and audiences. During the COVID crisis, Music Venue Trust mobilised music lovers to support the Save Our Venues campaign, raising over £5 million to support grassroots music venues and prevent closures. They worked hard to try and ensure that venues would survive and be ready to reopen when public health guidelines permitted. Now that some venues are able to reopen, Music Venue Trust is working to revive live, but that does not mean that all venues are financially secure. The next few months will continue to be challenging for everyone, and they will continue to fundraise for the venue support services Music Venue Trust offers, especially for those venues in need of the GMV crisis service. There are some exciting Save Our Venues projects still being worked on, so please do support where you can. Visit www.saveourvenues.co.uk to donate and do your part. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of We Didn't Know How Good We Had It. And this week, I am so happy to announce that I'm joined by Tom Hudson from Pulled Apart by Horses and Magic Mountain. Tom, how are you?
I'm good, yeah. How are you?
I'm very good, man. Thank you so much for joining me. Obviously, I'm taking the time out for having a little chat.
Yeah. Well, I haven't really got that much going on at the moment anyway, to be honest with you.
Oh, that's fair enough. Have you been pretty busy over the last year or so, though, with records and all sorts? And
I've been
keeping yourself busy, at least.
It's weird, yeah. It's like not busy in a normal life sort of way, because normally I'm kind of trying to do too much, like juggling two bands, work, like freelance work, and like social life, going to gigs all the time, pubs and seeing family, whatever. So yeah, like loads of it's kind of been simplified in a way, but kind of more introverted. So it's been good, but I've kind of like pushed myself to be productive and busy, even though for like the first half of lockdown I was like, I don't know, I think you have all these ideas and you see other people going like, oh, I've written a new lockdown album and all this stuff. Whereas for a while I was like, I just want to watch like Nicolas Cage films and
just do you
sit on my ass for a bit.
Do you for a bit, yeah. No, I think like I was sort of the same. The first, like, from let's say March last year through to like June or July, like you were saying, I was seeing all my really creative friends either, you know, saying, oh, I've written a whole new stand-up comedy thing I'm going to do over Zoom, or I've written a record or whatever.
Yeah.
And I've gone, I watched The American Office again.
Like I've just started that now.
Oh, good luck. I couldn't make it to the end because I don't like it when something I love ends. So I just leave it as a cliffhanger for myself. So the last few episodes are a mystery to me, but that's a wild ride, that is.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think like the pressure now to do stuff, like you said, that first few months seeing everyone doing creative things was, it put a lot of pressure on people's shoulders to do creative stuff when really, because most people didn't have the free time that they would normally have. But I think that sort of eased a little bit when you realize that actually I don't have to do stuff.
But now I
can if I'd like to.
It's almost like it's nice to have the time to do nothing for a bit.
Exactly.
And then get to that point where maybe you're like so bored or fed up of yourself or whatever that you're like, right, now I need to like fucking do something. Like I feel like I kind of go through cycles of that. I'm kind of like, I'm like a bit of a contradiction. I'm kind of like lazy. I love being lazy. I love playing computer games and watching films and being sat on my ass or whatever. But then at the same time, I've got like the Jekyll and Hyde, like another side that's like dead proactive, creative, like always thinking like I should be doing more, I should be doing stuff. So yeah, I think with like the whole lockdown thing, I've done like half and half. Like the first half I was just like, I'm just gonna coast it. I don't feel inspired. I kind of feel like I need a bit of a breather anyway.
Yeah.
And then with the second half, I've kind of gone like, right, I've had my
Nicolas Cage films.
yeah. Watch Nicolas Cage overact for a while, like time to mess around with some ideas and stuff.
I was going to say, because you've been pretty full on, I guess, for, well, let's say about 10 years. Is that a fair number to put on it with horses and stuff? So I bet it was nice to have the switch off button for the first few months, but I bet part of you, like you said, is it Jekyll or Hyde that's itching to get out to go, right, there has to be shows, there has to be live music, there has to be this. When's that going to happen again? I've got to get stuff ready for that inevitability.
Yeah, and it's like the uncertainty as well, isn't it? That's kind of weird because, I mean, I haven't got like the most conventional life anyway, so like, I'm used to like chopping and changing and being like, oh, I've got to work at this point, but then we're doing a tour at this point. And so my life's always like flipping around. But I've still been in control or known at least a little bit into the future of what's around the corner. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like if you've got freelance work on, you know that between March and July is work time, and then after that is tour time and recording time and all that sort of stuff, and then Christmas is downtime and eating too much time and all that sort of, and then just
you can kind of roughly plan it in.
But
with this, it's like, you know, when like even like the socially distanced gigs started creeping in again, like last summer, I was like, yes, here we go, like it's kind of coming back round. But then it did a total like 180, didn't it? So it's like I kind of feel like we're back at that point again now.
Yeah, I think everyone got too excited. That, not to sound cynical, but everyone got sort of too excited.
Everyone just ran out and started licking each other's faces.
Yeah, and just going, there's not a pandemic. Look, I'm outside. And you're like, oh, okay.
But it doesn't help when the weather's like really good as well. Everyone's just like, fuck it. Like,
that's the problem now, isn't it? Like, this is the same time as last year where we were all told to stay inside, full stop, no exercise, no nothing. And then obviously Boris allowed us to go and have 1 hour of prison yard time for a day.
I just walked up and down my garden for an hour.
So I didn't have a garden at the time. And I was sort of like, I mean, part of me was like, yes, it means that I don't have to go and do any exercise. Like I don't have the excuse to go, like, why haven't you just gone to do some exercise in the back garden or something? So then the other side to me was like, you're getting fat rich. You need to do something about it. Lagers don't help, man. Lagers don't help. Let's go into music, because like I said, I'm a huge fan of basically everything you and Horses and Magic Mountain have ever put out, really. And we discussed just before we had this chat about Mother Vulpine as well.
That's insane.
Yeah, it's like I've mentioned on the podcast before, I think I was mentioning it with Ben Forrester, about the Eagles of Death Metal gig that I saw you guys supporting at without realizing who you were. And then 5 or so years later, two favorite bands are Pulled Apart by Horses and Dinosaur Pileup. And it's such a lovely, like, basically, like, Leeds is unstoppable, I think was my thought at one point. Like, there was all these great bands from where I'm from in the Midlands, but then you look at the Leeds family and the bands that are up there. And like you said, it's a weird band incestual sort of family tree up there, isn't it? It's pretty amazing. But how did you get started in your sort of musical ventures then?
I'm originally from Birmingham, like Hales Owen, West Midlands, but I went to when I was about like 12 or 11, I started playing guitar and like manifesting being in a band. I was like into like Nirvana and Smashing Pumpkins and all that sort of stuff. And I was just like, I don't know what I want to do in my life apart from at some point I want to play guitar or play music and make noise and be on a stage. And then started messing around in sort of semi bands when I was like about 15 or when I was still at school, like high school. And then went to art college, met like other musicians and stuff, as you do, like other creatives, and started playing in like bands where we were like kind of like inspired by like At the Drive-In and kind of like post-hardcore sort of stuff. And then came to university to do visual communications, which is basically like graphic design, art and design sort of stuff at the Leeds College of Art and Design. And then, I don't know, it's so weird how stuff happens. Like, you just naturally get, like, you naturally gravitate. Stuff with
people, don't you? Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember, like, one of the first days or something at uni, I met Matt Bigland from Pile Up that I was in with, in Volpine with. Linz, who's my partner, who I've been with for like 15 years, 16 years or something since. And then I remember Matt saying like, oh, you play guitar. And then like a week later, me and him went and had a jam. And the dude that turned up to play drums at the time was Nestor, who's in Magic Mountain now, that was also in Skylark in A Menace Beach. And I didn't even know him. We just went into a rehearsal space and started fucking about. But it's like, it's dead weird how easy it all sort of like comes together without you even like meaning to or trying.
Well, like, it's like you mentioned just before we started recording about like going to gigs and being able to just sort of like, you got a pint in your hand and you sort of look at someone, you give them the nod because you recognize them from another gig, and then you start chatting to them from there. Yeah. And even if you don't know them, you know them more from just being at the same sort of place and having the same tastes as them.
Actually, I think I remember Matt saying like the first day of uni, he thought I was like a total like indie boy, because I think, I don't know how I was dressed, maybe like wearing like skinny jeans, but I had like a blazer on or something, or a scarf or something that was like
a scarf, you indie boys and your
yeah, something that
materials.
Yeah. Something that threw something out confusingly. But then
was that just a phase? Was it the blazer and a scarf?
Yeah, no t-shirt or shirt underneath, just a blazer with like my nipples out. And then I remember Matt saying like, he was like, oh, I thought you were an indie boy, but then I realized you were wearing a Your Code Name is Milo t-shirt. And he was like, oh shit. And then we had to do this like project over like before we started uni that was like an about me sort of thing. I remember like just putting up some pictures of like me playing guitar. And I think like him and Linz were like, because they knew each other from the year before doing foundation, I think they were like, oh, he plays guitar. And then like, and then we just started chatting like in the first week. It was really weird.
That's great how it all just sort of comes together. Like I said, if you go to places where you've got creative minded people, it can still be quite hard to get, you know, find the right creative minded people. It sounds like you found, or in my opinion, you definitely found the right creative minded people to start off with.
Yeah. Yeah. I've kind of been lucky, really. I've kind of just fallen into quite a lot of stuff without really meaning to.
You mentioned obviously a few bands there, like Your Code Name is Milo and At the Drive-In and stuff. We'll talk about a little bit later on and everything, but were those the sort of bands that got you into, let's just look at Pull Apart the Horses for starters, because the first couple of albums and the first shows and everything were known for loud, fast, hard, like tongue in cheek, 100 mile an hour. Did you get pull influence from bands like that? Because I suppose At the Drive-In, you can sort of compare a live Pull Apart the Horses show to an At the Drive-In show, if you don't mind me saying,
with the same level of energy. I think, yeah, it was all about the energy. Like, I remember seeing, first time I saw At the Drive-In was on TFI Friday that Chris Evans used to present, and it just totally like blew me away. Like, I hadn't heard him before, and it's just that thing where there's so much energy on stage. Like, there's like Omar's guitars going out of tune. It's like on the wonk. And
when you said going out of tune, they had to have been in tune in the first place for them to go out of tune.
Well, yeah, it's just like all over the shop. Like, Cedric's vocals are like intermittent. They're like coming in and out, like, you know, cutting in. He can't hit some of the notes, but like just seeing him, it was like a ball of energy. It was like a total explosion, and it didn't fucking matter at all, because it was just so captivating. Like, just like, it's like someone's just like chucked a bomb on stage and then gone, like, let it go off. Like,
yeah. When Tom from Goddamn in our chat was we talked about the Mars Volta, which obviously basically is At the Drive-In, but he described it as the Mars Volta are like the lounge version of At the Drive-In. So if you go to see the Mars Volta, if anyone's ever going to be lucky enough to see them again, you stand and you watch and you admire like their musicianship and how they do it. And then he described the last 10 minutes of that Mars Volta gig he went to as at the drive-in mode, where everything just kicked off and went 0 to 100 real quick.
It's like it's slowly ramping up and then it just goes, whoa!
Yeah, and it sort of separates the, I'm not going to say fans from the real fans because that's unfair, but the people who were there because they've heard about these crazy wild live shows, and then those who are there because they know it's going to happen at some point, but they're happy to experience everything that was before. I mean, I'd do anything to see the Mars Volta again. They'd be one of the bands I'd discuss if I interviewed myself on this as well. But and
yeah, totally.
Lucky enough to see at the drive-in a few years back on tour with Death From Above, and they were every ounce of amazing as I wanted them to be, and hoped that they would be as well. Obviously, they're a bit older now. So yeah, as much as
I saw them on the Reform when they did Leeds Festival.
Mm.
On like the Enemy stage, and it was really good, but I don't know. I think Omar had gone through something at the time, or like maybe like something like really bad, like his mom had passed away or something. Mm. And you could just tell that he wasn't connected to it.
He wasn't quite as present as they usually are.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there was something about that where, like, you know, fair enough, you're not always going to play your best gig, but I think because I'd like fantasized about them so much and watched so many like bootleg videos of them in like 2000 and stuff, that I wanted them to do the same thing, and it wasn't that. So in a way I was a bit disappointed, but then nothing beats hearing it live anyway, those songs. Yeah, that's true. Love, like that,
you can still say you were there
anyway.
Yeah, I remember like staying up when they headlined Coachella to think it was 2012 or something, and staying up pretty much till 4 or 5 in the morning to watch a live stream, and it was fucking dreadful. And they were, we joke about them and being like out of tune and stuff.
Sound.
Oh, everything about it ruined that for me, but didn't put me off them. Cause obviously if anyone knows, at the drive-in, you know, they're known for listen to the record. It's the most polished thing you can possibly listen to. And it's so well put together, and then live, literally anything can happen.
Well, that, like you were saying about like, did that inspire Horses? And like, I think that was like a big part of Horses, where like I, all of us knew James before the band started, but we didn't know each other. So like, I hadn't really met Lee before, and I'd met Rob like a couple of times, maybe. I think I might've got drunk or seen him at a few gigs. Mm. I think I played Guitar Hero with him once in James's lounge.
Nice.
But like, yeah, it was just these like four guys that didn't really know each other that well that turned up to write some songs together. We didn't really know what it was. And then like we played like the first gig and it just sort of kicked off, and there was like that energy was there within it without us even like talking about it. And I think like that sort of at the drive-in mentality where like when they did like the Jules Holland performance. And,
oh yeah, when Robbie Williams was like, "Can my friend have his chair back, please?" at the end.
yeah, when it pans to him after. And like just that the logic behind Omar when he's like, "Okay, my guitar neck's broken or something. It's not holding any sound, any tuning." So rather than like trying to like put his tuner on and tune it up, he just chucks his guitar and gets a pair of maracas
and starts shaking it in the middle. And he's like slack. He has his guitar pedals raised up on, again, this is for the guitar nerds out there. He has it raised up on a platform and must have a MIDI input somewhere. And he's just playing his guitar pedals like a set of bongos and just switching them on and off. Yeah. Obviously he's got the wildest pedal board in the entire world.
Yeah. So it's just like tripping out.
I wonder who was on more, let's say, supplements between at the drive-in or Robbie Williams on that show.
Medicinal supplements.
Yeah, you know, you've just got to be at a certain level, I guess. But maybe they just thought, maybe they looked at Robbie Williams and were like, we have to try and outdo this guy.
I think with at the drive-in, I think it's like 50-50 in it. I think definitely Cedric and Omar are on their medicinal supplements. Mm. And then like the bassist and drummer are just stone cold sober, absolutely hating it, but holding it all together.
Well, so they're saying that Jim, the other guitarist, is basically like the middle of At the Drive-In, because
Jim's the backbone. Any like,
yeah, it's like without Jim, there was no At the Drive-In, because he's the only one who probably knows all the songs, like to play them all the way through.
It's like he's cueing them when the backing vocals come in, and then the guitar, it's almost like he's like going like, looking over to Omar, like, it's this bit, mate. Come on.
Like, E-flat, cue. E-flat, Omar, E-flat.
Yeah, just like giving him the nod.
So with horses starting and stuff, was there a plan behind Pulled Apart by Horses being this type of like crazy wild party band? Or is it right in you saying it just happened? It wasn't like guys, I've got a really good idea. I'm going to take my shirt off and see what I can climb on, and it's going to be fucking insane. Or was it just, it just happened? Or what was the sort of idea?
It just happened, really. Like, we didn't really plan anything. Like, Rob, James and Lee had a couple of practices, wrote a few songs before I joined. And I think they were just like, oh, we need someone to do vocals, or we need a singer. And then at the time, my previous band, Mother Vulpine, had split up. And so I was at a bit of a loose end creatively. And then James just said, like, oh, do you fancy coming to a practice? I think I'd done some artwork for James for horses to use online before I was even in the band. Cause it was like, oh, could you draw us a logo and stuff? And then he just said, like, oh, do you fancy like just coming along and just seeing what happens, like how it goes? And then I think I had like, weirdly, I think I'd banked High Five and Punch a Lion. I had it recorded on like my phone or like on my laptop, and I didn't have anywhere else for it to be. So I remember, like, even from like one of the first practices with everyone, I was just like, oh, I've got this idea. And then it just sort of happened. It's so weird.
Amazing.
And then like all the shows after that, like we were just kind of like oblivious. Like we all thought that the band was probably going to end within like a couple of months or something, because it was such a like,
chaotic good.
Yeah, because it was just like a little, you know, I keep saying it, but like a little time bomb or something, because it was so on the edge, but we kind of thrived on that. So we were kind of like, our mentality was like, play every gig like it's your last. And that's probably, I don't know, I feel like I've kind of like had that mentality up until now, like all the time, which is kind of like, which is fucking knackering.
I say, at least like last year was good then, if you needed to just slow down just a bit. You can start leveling it back up again now, everything's starting to reopen.
Yeah.
Touch wood.
Yeah. So, I'm totally itching to like play another show. And we've got some things on like the horizon, which like we've kind of like backed off from it for a while because of all like the COVID stuff and lockdown and whatever. And we didn't want to like, I've seen so many like tours that have been like rearranged and stuff that it's like,
it's heartbreaking for everyone involved, isn't it? That, because not just yourselves as the artists going out and sitting in the van and hiring a van and doing all that sort of stuff, but the promoters and the venues and the fans, like, everybody gets disappointed, all for different reasons, obviously, but you know.
You feel like you're letting them down. But at the same time, everyone has like different reasons for going to that gig, or
exactly,
you know, they might not even live in that city and they've booked like a little holiday to go to it or anything. Like, yeah, it's weird, isn't it? You can't, it's kind of, everything's on the back burner a little bit. But now we're like having conversations and it kind of feels positive and stuff's coming together, which is cool.
Is it good having, because obviously with horses, like I said, it's really full on, and sort of like, I guess it takes a strain on your vocals and stuff every other night and stuff. But Magic Mountain is a bit more, I'd say, subdued. It's still party, like it's got the rhythms, it's got all the energy that goes in there. But do you find like now you've got the other Magic Mountain records out and you're able to go and start playing shows again, hopefully by the end of this year, if there's obviously you've got plans for that, that'll probably just amp you up more for doing everything. You could just do a Magic Mountain Pulled Apart by Horses tour and just do the whole thing.
I'd be fucking knackered. I'd be so knackered.
You can have an interval and then...
Plus, I wouldn't have any time to go and get some food or whatever. I'd just be like on the edge.
Musicians don't eat. They don't get fed at venues. Come on.
No, just a nutritious lager.
And how was releasing the record, the Magic Mountain record then? How did you find that in sort of the time that it is now, where you were saying like having the music is a way of spearheading a tour in a way? Obviously the music's the most important part because you put so much effort into writing and recording it, but you do that to then go out and play it live, especially someone like said, someone like yourself who thrives on playing it live, and Lindsay as well.
Yeah.
How was it for you guys?
Well, it was really good, actually. I mean, the only like downfall is the fact that we couldn't play it live. So when the album was released, we didn't have a release show, and we couldn't like go like, oh, here's the tunes. This is what we've been building up to like the whole time. But then it kept me busy, like, because we were like chatting to a few labels and stuff, and like we were literally chatting to people. I think we had a few like Zoom chats like 2 weeks before like the lockdown hit. So we were kind of starting to like set up connections and whatever for like releasing the album, because we already had like the bare bones of it. Well, most of it already recorded because we did it ourselves.
Yeah.
And then loads of people had so much other shit to deal with that we didn't really hear back from anyone for like a long time. So we were just like, me and Linz were just like, well, fuck it. Like, let's just demystify, like, you know, releasing a record, and let's just figure it out because we've got the time. Do you know what I mean? So yeah, it just kept us really busy. Like, we're doing like working on like the promo. Like, I had like all the artwork to do, so I just had a really rough idea of like the album cover.
Yeah.
And then like it took me like a month to sort of put all the pieces together, and then when we sent that off to get pressed, you know, to make the record and the CDs and stuff, then every month, like, I had to do like the artwork for each single that we're releasing and stuff. So basically, so you had
a plan to sort of like a job, I guess, a job on everything as it's gone. Like,
So like, I'd finish one single artwork design, and then I'd be like, fucking hell, like, it's that time again. Like, I've like, just can got we just to start the next
stop
one.
Releasing
straight
some
away.
Music for a little bit, like, just have a break from. I'm having a break from music for a year.
Yeah.
You were also doing a lot of like Spotify playlists and things like that, weren't you, with a lot of the bands that. Bands are friends with, influenced by, and everything as well. How did those go down? Because I saw you did one a week, but didn't was it one a week?
Yeah, we started doing them like every Friday, and it was kind of like, I guess you've kind of done it with the podcast in a way as well. It's like just setting like little things to focus on, and like, so even like doing those playlists, like we had like quite a lot of fun, but also like it gave us a bit of a routine. We were just like, okay, it's Friday's coming up. It was like Nesta or Linz or me would like do a playlist of stuff we've been listening to or dig, or we'd do it sort of themed. So it'd be like, you know, like one would be like Linz would put like loads of like kind of inspiring female artists. And then I did one that was on like weird Afrobeat psychedelia stuff. And like, it was really cool to just like go off on one a little bit. And show people what's kind of, you've been filtering, you know, to make your music as well.
Yeah, I suppose, like you said, with the routine, I mean, like, you are right. I've done the same thing. I've basically set myself up for a fall by having to release one of these every Friday for as long as I can possibly try and do them for.
Is that how often you're doing them?
Yeah, so I record them just for anyone's there. I record one or two a week with people if I got the time, or if they've got the time, and obviously... Then I love having that noise in the podcast, by the way, that can open.
Oh, yeah.
It's the second time it's happened now. And then, like, releasing them every Friday. And it's sort of, I like releasing, like, the new guest is going to be on a Tuesday, if anyone hasn't noticed that already on social media and stuff. And it gives me that few days to, like, for usually people are messaging me going, oh, I can't wait for this episode. Like, the Samoans episode, which came out on Friday, just gone. I'm recording this now. So it's a, you can all do the maths there. People messaging me going, yeah, we're from the future now, guys. messaging me saying, oh, I'm really looking forward to hearing this. And it drives me, probably the same as you, and it drives me to then do it again the next week and the next week after that. Like, you've got people engaging with something that you're doing. And you may be just doing it the same as me to like pass the time and have a great conversation or listen to new music that you've not heard or at least for a very long time. And it means something more to someone else. So yeah, it's
I kind of feel like people are doing that more at the moment, whether it's due to like boredom or, you know, not being able to like go to gigs as much or whatever. But I feel like I kind of hope like it sticks as well at the same time. Yeah.
I feel like a lot of people have put a lot of effort into it. I know this is a bit of a curveball on everyone here listening, but people have put a lot of effort into producing content. And like you said, whether I'd stop them being bored or to give them a bit of routine or to help them with their mental health or anything like that. And
yeah, totally.
I really hope people don't stop doing those things because, you know, if it's done them good, it's done a lot of people a lot of good as well. I mean, I've had way more listens on this podcast, and this is a thank you to everyone who has, than I ever thought I would. I didn't think anyone would want to listen to my Brummy drawl for, you know, an hour every week and have the guests on and stuff. Not that they do listen to me, they listen to you guys more than anything, but it means a lot.
I might make an edit of the podcast where I just cut out all the guests and just leave your voice.
Tom were discussing about like how we both dislike our own voices on record, and now that's on record as well. Listen to my own voice back and editing these podcasts back and hearing myself ask some of the stupid questions that I do when I've got a bit of a brain fart. Hate it so much, but alas, yeah. I love the conversations.
If you cut out the amount of times I said like, you'd probably have like an hour less.
There was another one there.
There you go. Yeah.
Let's move on to some bands then. Like properly, we'll delve deep now. Where do you want to start? Basically, this is Tom Hudson's episode of We Didn't Know How Good He Had It. Let's just delve into someone.
I might just do it kind of in order. I don't know. Well, it's that not helps in me because
that's how I wrote
order.
Them down. So that would be
helpful. But it's kind of what. When you asked me to do this, it's kind of what like first came into my head, really. Yeah. And then there was a few others where I was like, oh shit, like how have I not mentioned them or whatever? But like the first one that I thought of was Your Code Name Is Milo.
Mm-hmm.
Who were like I was saying before, like me, Matt and Linz were kind of like bonded when we were doing like Vulpine through like me wearing like a Milo t-shirt and stuff. And at the time they were like a band that were like dead exciting, that were kind of doing something that we wanted to do, where it was like, it was kind of like beyond, it was kind of like you mentioned, like Ruben and maybe like Biffy were kind of in that same world at the time,
that noisy three piece sort of.
Yeah, it was kind of like Britain's answer to like to kind of like post-hardcore or like alternative rock. There was definitely like not necessarily a sound or aesthetic that you could that went throughout it, because it's kind of all over the place, but these bands kind of stuck together and kind of popped out quite a bit as well.
I was quite late to the party with Your Code Name Is Milo, and a lot of my friends really shit on me online for only discovering them a couple of years back. But they've got like this, you were saying that the sound that they have when I first started listening to them is like that electronic sound underneath everything. Maybe like, it might not be a synth or something, but it's like a looped guitar sound that,
well, I think
drags you in.
I think it's cause, they had they had three guitarists. So there was like, Justin, who was kind of like, he's kind of like thrashing his guitar. Paul, who's singing and playing guitar, who's like a bit more like spiky and angular. And then Adam, I think his name was, the other guitarist, who's playing these, he's kind of like holding it together. He's like playing more like singular notes and stuff. But it all kind of like, it was quite spiky and kind of.
Like they'd like deconstructed it. And yeah, then like pulled it all back together.
Like I'd listen to like the songs and I'd just be like, how the fuck did they write this? Like how does this happen when they're in a room together? It didn't feel like a thing that you could, if one of them just played it on guitar, it wouldn't sound anywhere like the song. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, but then you put it all together, it sort of,
yeah, it feels
somehow managed to glue itself into this like weird angular
and then
stuff.
And then their first album was recorded by Steve Albini, who is like an amazing producer that's done like, well, he's in Shellac, but also did like Nirvana in Utero and I can't think off the top of my head.
Me and Tom Goddamn had a big Steve Albini conversation. I think, I'll be honest with you, in the podcast, I might have edited a lot of it out because I think, not for lack of not wanting to talk about Albini, I think he had to move room or something, but I'll find that for the outtakes or something there. But we were talking about like the Albini sound, which
you
hear a lot on that record, which apparently is you just add some reverb and then like onto all of your drums and then you're pretty much on your way to it. But I think I've boiled it down a little bit too much there, but
I think it just captures people in a raw sort of way. There's no like dressing it up. If you're shit, then your recording's gonna sound shit, basically. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's just like a reflection of the band captured in a really energetic, raw sort of way. So I think when they did that, like, I remember speaking to them, they were saying that it was like, because they had to like fly over to like New York to record it, they had like minimal budget. So it was literally just like a flash in the pan. Like, they just captured what they had and then like left. And then yeah, Steve did, I think, his thing. just worked really well. So yeah, got them. First time I saw them play, they were supporting McCluskey in Birmingham at the Birmingham Academy 2, the upstairs one.
Yeah.
The old academy sort of thing.
Yeah.
And that was like one of those moments where I went to see the support band over McCluskey. Like, I'd heard McCluskey and I liked some of their stuff, but I didn't get into them until later on. But I went there to see Milo, which was, it's quite weird, isn't it? When you go to see a support band rather than the band they're supporting.
That seems to be happening a lot, I guess, in the acts, in the bands that we would know. A lot of our friends are supporting bigger acts, like Dinosaur Pileup are touring with Enter Shikari. And back in the day, I would have been super, super hyped to see Enter Shikari, but now they've become a radio-friendly unit shifter, for all lack of a lack of respect there. But I thought you said
reindeer-friendly unit shifter.
Yeah, they could be both. Who knows? I'd happily go and see the support act over like the main act and stuff. But with McCluskey, though, I think you might upset a few people there, because obviously McCluskey was, thankfully they're back now, but
that was the opposite thing, where, you know, like you were saying with where you saw like Volpine play supporting Eagles of Death Metal and you'd never heard of us and you're like, oh shit, these are pretty cool. It was like the reverse of that. So I went to see the support band play for like 15 fucking minutes or something and didn't really know much about McCluskey, and then I stuck around obviously to watch them, and I was like, I had that like feeling where I was like, oh shit, I should have done my homework with this. You know what I mean? I should have like listened to more of their stuff before, because, well, I think they like broke up after that as well.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been too long after that, if that's the right sort of time frame, like 2004, 2005-ish.
But
yeah, I mean, with McCluskey, obviously, that they're one of those bands now. Like, I'm the same. I was chatting with Damien from the St. Pierre Snake Invasion about McCluskey, who, he's now the bass player in that band. With them.
Yeah.
And I was saying to him, like, I listened to Future of the Left before I listened to McCluskey, and I wasn't even aware of McCluskey until I went to a Future of the Left show. And then they played Lightsaber Cocksucking Blues at the end of a Future of the Left show. And I was like, what the fuck is this? Where did this come from? Like, and then after that, I was like, well, I've slept on that for too long. And now I live in Cardiff. I've got no excuse to not talk about McCluskey with everyone, because either everyone was either a McCluskey fan or a Jar Crew fan or both.
Local heroes. I really want to go to that gig that Jar Crew are reforming to support them.
I'm really hoping that, I mean, pretty sure it's going to happen. They haven't announced it for Cardiff yet, but I'm pretty sure there's going to be a week-long residency in Clubby Fullback with McCluskey and Jar Crew. So that will keep everybody happy, because they did...
And it'd be amazing to see Kelson back on the stage, because he hasn't done it for ages.
Yeah.
Last time I saw him, he came to see Horses play when we were down for like Soon Festival or something. And I was just chatting to him because he'd left Future of the Left at that point. Future of the Left. And he was like, "Yeah, I'm studying to be a dentist." And I was like, "What? That's crazy, but
rock and roll. Play, like, that's where cool. the money's at, isn't it?
Yeah, totally.
You have to get pulled up by horses on the support from McCluskey tour, then, eh? You heard it.
Yeah,
first,
yeah.
Guys.
I thought you were going to say we'd after all become dentists. I was like,
I mean, we've all got time. We're only in our 30s. It'll be fine.
Dental rock.
Hey, I think Bowen from Idols is a dentist, so that's proof that you can do both, right?
If I was a dentist, at least I'd be able to like repair my own teeth after I've smashed them to bits at a gig.
Yeah, you're not too worried about having too much of a chaotic gig if you know you can go home and do your own backstreet dentistry.
I think like 50% of my front teeth are fake. Just the amount of times I've just like smashed them with a mic.
So there'll be a conversation for a different podcast. We'll do a rock and roll injuries podcast, and I'll have to get you on for one of those ones.
Yeah, we'd be on it for hours.
Let's move on then, because obviously your codename is Milo, big band from the Northeast. They did announce they did announce a reunion show at the Clooney, which was due to take place last September, I believe, to help raise money for that. And that obviously, as you probably understand, it sold out incredibly quickly. I don't know if you managed to get tickets for it or not, but
yeah, me, Linz and Nestor got tickets for the Clooney one, because that was the first one that got announced, wasn't it?
So hopefully, you know, they haven't cancelled it. So it will be hopefully it won't be a one-off, but it'll be one of the best one-offs, I think, of the last decade or so. They might need to raise more money to repair the Clooney afterwards, I think, if it goes a little bit off in there. There's a great, there's a great line from Paul from Your Codename is Milo. And he says something, and when someone asks him if Your Codename is Milo is dead, he goes, no, it's just resting. Who knows, we might go to the Clooney, have a big fuck-off burger and see how it goes after that. And we're like, well, there you go. There's a little bit of optimism to go.
Yeah. Totally.
Let's move on. If we're sort of going down the list, this list is amazing, by the way. It's a band called Kong, which I was saying to you before, pretty hard to find any information about. And I had to make sure I found the right Kong, because there's about 97,000 other bands called Kong in the world. Let's dive into them. The members of Oceanside, if I've got that right.
Yeah, so Steve and I can't remember the drummer's name, they were members of Oceanside, and then John Martin, the front man, has done like loads of different things. He was in a band called Then Thickens. And he did loads of like guitar teching for bands. Like, he was really good mates with like the Bronx and stuff. Kong are like amazing but really weird, just like one of those bands that feel like they've just turned up in a spaceship out of nowhere. They've just appeared, like, you know, in the circuit, and you're just like, what the fuck is this? And like, so if like people haven't seen them before, they're basically just like always wearing red, like red t-shirt, red trousers, wearing these like really weird see-through masks that have got makeup on them that are like, I think there was a horror film in like the 70s where like the villain was like wearing these masks, but they're just like kind of smiling but really gruesome at the same time.
I saw a few pictures of them. I was like, is this the same band? And I looked, and I sort of put two and two together with the sort of music that I know you'd be listening to, and thought, right, these are the right guys. And I had a listen, and it's noise rock. Let's just throw that in there. But I was hearing a lot of bands that I've sort of put on, like Blacklisters and USA Nails and things like that. You can hear a lot of the influence from this band. So they're all tied
together. Because Steve is now playing bass in Blacklisters and guitar and singing in USA Nails. So it's like part of that world, it's kind of come out of it.
So I love that sort of, I know it's noise rock. I remember trying to describe noise rock to a friend who likes sort of Ed Sheeran and acts like that, and I was like, you can't really describe it. It's a sound that every single noise rock band has, where there's like a level of white noise or harsh noise just there. It's still music, like it's still a guitar making this sound, but
it's more like percussive.
Yeah,
it kind of reminds me of like, like 2001 Space Odyssey, the monkeys at the beginning, like the kind of Neanderthal men that are like hitting bones and beating each other up and throwing them in the air. It's kind of like, I kind of imagine them, but with guitars and drumsticks, just hacking away at stuff. Just like
Stanley Kubrick wanted it to be. some Northern English noise rock bands from 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Yeah, just like a weird sense of like kind of primal sort of like instinct within it, where you're just like hitting stuff, like just creating this sort of like abrasive sound.
It's quite a strange, like, I love listening to bands like Blacklist and things. It's usually a lot of people, when they listen to music to calm themselves down, they do, you know, put the radio on and have a bit of a talk and stuff like that. But I'll quite happily sit and listen to bands like Blacklisters, and now I will be listening to Kong from now on, because it has this sort of all-encompassing sort of sound to it, where it's so abrasive that you can't help but be involved in it.
Yeah, totally.
Like it sort of swallows you up a bit. And I feel like if you turn it off at any point, the band knows that you've turned the music off, and they just hear it and they go, oh, you're getting in.
Yeah, it's like they're daring you to like carry on listening. Yeah. Like, I bet you can't listen to this whole thing. And you're like, all right, well, I'll fucking do my best, mate.
I remember putting Blacklisters on at the Flapper. I think I've got the poster knocked around somewhere a few years back. And I knew that they were going to be a bit of a nightmare in a good way. Right, because that's just how they are. And my good friend Stuart from a band called Den Wolves, again, another one of those bands I want to get back together, was having Billy stop at his house. And he was like, I basically had to put every piece of my like valuable stuff that he could knock off the side, you know, somewhere away, because he's just like having that kid that comes home from school that, you know, and he just wants to pick everything up and go, what's this? But on their rider, it had like, you know, your standard, just a hot meal for everyone. And then in bold at the bottom was a framed picture of Eddie Vedder for the dressing room.
Yeah.
Like, okay,
we're river floor.
This dude photoshopped a picture of, Mary and Joseph and the baby Jesus, and he photoshopped Eddie Vedder's face onto all of them and bought it framed in for Billy. And it was like one of the best, honestly, like, I think I peaked at shows then. It was absolutely fucking perfect.
That's where Horses fails. Like, we need to put more weird shit in our rider.
I feel like I always try, and if I get a rider from a band, fulfill it, obviously to a point. But if there's stuff like that on it, you can't not, like,
you've got to try and figure it out.
Exactly. Like the guys in a band called Spring King, they were the same. I booked them a couple of times, and their rider was different every single day of the week. So they knew they were going to have a different type of meal or whatever every day of the week. And I was like, I appreciate that, because you could send it out to, you know, on a
That's
whole tour.
That's a really good idea. I remember Steve from Blood Red Shoes was saying, get postcards for the local area and socks. And I was just like, yeah, like the amount of times you run out of socks on tour.
Honestly, like, genuinely, promoters, or at least myself, I say promoters, I would do that for you. I'll buy you some socks if you come down and play in Cardiff. Yeah.
That's actually our fee, just socks.
Well, it's gone down, that's all right then.
But a million pairs of socks.
So yeah, don't undersell yourself, please.
I remember that band, Frankie and the Heartstrings, like, chatting to one of those guys once, and they said on their rider, they put a shrine to David Hasselhoff at the very bottom.
Yeah.
And then they played a gig in Germany once, I think. And they said, like, they walked into the dressing room, they'd been on tour for ages, and there was just this giant poster of the Hoff with like candles underneath.
Incredible. See, it's things like that that you could put the most nonsense stuff in your rider. And this is for any young aspiring musicians here listening. Do it, because somebody will live up to that for you one day. And it'll
even
be
if it only happens once, it's worth it, isn't it?
Exactly. It's the story. Then you can say, look what we got. So
one of my friends, a couple of my friends used to work for ATP that put on the festivals.
Yeah.
And they just did some like fucking amazing gigs, put on some amazing bands. And they sent me a PDF file of Iggy and the Stooges rider.
I bet it's insane.
And it should be published. It should be in a book. It's about 35 pages long, and it's just fucking insane. Like, it just goes off on these like crazy narratives, or it's talking about the dimensions of a specific chair that it wants, that they want, and like.
And I bet they don't even give a shit. Like,
no, they probably know that it's not going to happen, but it's like
it's entertaining for the TM at least to go to the tick bookman. I think Foo Fighters did that, didn't they? They did. Their rider was a coloring book, and they did a coloring book for every like big arena tours. Like everyone that was working on the back got a Foo Fighters coloring book with all the rider and questions and all sorts of stuff in it. So
that's good.
Yeah. That probably cost them most of the door fees and everything on there. But
yeah.
Moving on from Kong, because this list is long, by the way, and it's very.
I know. I don't think I'll go through everything. I think
no. Go ahead. Like you take it away, but. Should we go through, is it this et al? Is that how you pronounce it?
This et al, yeah. They're like a Leeds band. They were like one of the first local bands I saw when I came to Leeds. Like I remember seeing like a poster for, there was like a pub called The Vine, and there was a poster in the window, and it was Forward Russia, who are like another fantastic band that split up that were like pretty cool. It was them supporting a band called This et al. I remember just seeing the description, and This et al, it said like Sonic Youth, Mogwai, Queens of Stone Age, and then Ford Russia was like Fugazi at the drive-in, math rock-esque, whatever. I remember just going to see it and then just thinking, fucking hell, like this is what the local bands are. This is so cool. And then maybe like a year later or something, both bands just sort of started getting a bit of traction and doing more things and stuff. And I think that sort of opened my eyes up to like the Leeds music scene a bit. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I remember like one minute, like in this tiny shitty pub, that's basically like half the day, it's just full of alcoholics propping up the bar. And then the second half, like Whiskers, who was in Ford Rush, is just putting on his own gigs, like random bands that he's sort of like found out and stuff.
Well, like and, I said, at one point, like Leeds just could not be stopped with the amount of bands that were coming out of them. I think I'm pretty sure you can look online. There's an NME article from back then with like Ford Russia and talking about bands. And I believe you guys, Pull Pop Horses, were in there as well. Because there was, it's insane the amount of bands that you can like just name that came from that scene. Or if it was like you said, one person was from the north and had this creative energy that got another four people who were in a band with them. And then all of a sudden they're like some of the biggest bands in the United Kingdom as well.
It's weird, isn't it? It's kind of
what's
like,
in the water up there, man? What is in the water up there? There's got to be something.
It's not water. It's just Yorkshire tea. The taps are brown and flowing with Yorkshire tea.
You pay extra for that. That's why the inflation is so high. Like.
Never get clean though, having a bath in tea.
You just always smell great though. That's right.
Yeah, but I don't know, like that kind of opened my eyes up to like the local scene and stuff without really like, you know, just saw a poster, but like I was like, oh shit, there's this like community of bands that are as good as you know, the bands they've listed, like Queens of the Stone Age at the drive-in or whatever. But they're like, you'll see them working in like co-op like or do you know what I mean? Like you'll bump into them at like little gigs in like
you're that guy who screamed at me on Thursday night in front of six of the people in the pub.
And it's like like the community's kind of like woven around that sort of thing.
Are there any more bands on this list that sort of falls into that category again? Because there's a lot of northern bands, and obviously rightfully so, that around the same time, like we figured out, like a lot of these bands started out around 2002, 2003 and went through either maybe, you know, till a couple of years ago or, late 2000s.
I think with like, what I want to say about like This Tell is that they massively inspired Mother Vulpine at the time. To the point where when we first started writing stuff, we kind of ripped them off a bit. And then after a while, we kind of like, you know, developed our own style and sound. But they were kind of like the blueprint. We'd like seen them play loads and we were just like, shit, like these guys are really exciting. And it's what kind of like, it's kind of the glue that got me, Linz and Matt together as well to start like writing and stuff.
Yeah.
Which is cool. And it's really weird because I'm just like mates with most of those guys now and I know them really well, but just like coming to Leeds and not knowing any of them, I was just like, fucking hell, it's so weird.
They're like rock stars, isn't it? It's like,
yeah.
I know it sounds really silly and cliche, but
you've got that image of them in your mind and yeah. You see them on stage still and you're just like, fuck, this is amazing. And now it's just like, yeah, we go to the pub together and hang out and whatever.
I say this sort of pretty much every week to everyone I chat with, because I consider myself incredibly lucky to chat to people like yourself. And I've had the guys from Johnny Foreigner and the guys from Ruben as well. And I say this every week, people who are in those acts who are no longer together, they're so humble when you like get to have a conversation with them about the band that they were in. Like John and Guy thanked me for asking them to chat about their band. And I was like, yeah. I don't think you realize how much it means to me that you'd say yes for starters. And, you know, could say yes and then pull me off. That's fine. But like the fact that they're happy to do it, but it's almost like...
I'm not
like,
pulling you off.
No, pulled off by horses.
yeah.
But like, I was like, it means a lot of these bands mean a lot more to the fans than the people who are in the bands actually realize as well.
Yeah.
And it's a really humbling thing. Like you said, that you're really good friends with these guys. You go and sit in the pub with them. And they're still those guys from the stage that blew you away the first time you saw them. But now they're your mates and they're the guys that blew you off. blew you away from the stage there. Yeah. I'm getting, there's a bit of a complex going on here. Sorry, man.
No, it is weird, isn't it? It's kind of... You've got that weird thing then where you like... You still admire them in the same way, but it's kind of demystified or the barrier's broken. Do you
yeah,
know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it's like when we were discussing just before about you sharing a lockup with any other band and just standing outside the door before you're loading in and hearing any act writing a song. And then yeah. A couple of weeks down the line, you go and see them in a pub or you support them or they're playing in the show or you hear it on the radio or whatever. And you go, I heard them writing that. And it sounds where I would have taken it, or like you can hear...
Yeah, it's
like
cool.
How it goes from there. It's great to be part of that sort of scene.
It's like you're with them on the journey, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's I like to be a bit of an independent stand to the side because I'm not really a musician as much anymore. But being able to like support my friends in writing their music or being sent a single that they're not releasing for another 6 months just to hear it because they want to hear what people have to say about it. It's really nice. It's nice to be wanted. Eh?
Yeah, but I like that, like my mate Ryan, who's in Menace Beach and a new band, well, newish band called Yard Act. He does that thing where he just like drinks loads of beers like late at night and just writes music. Like that's his kind of, he's like a bit of a night owl. That's his time when he does stuff. And it'll be like Garage Band or Logic Demos or whatever. And he'll send me like SoundCloud links to like just a demo or an idea saying like, oh, what do you think to this? And like, that's like another part of that you were saying. It's like you're getting like a little insight into like the
way that they think, like, I guess, and the way that they process like their creativity. It's like
embryo of the song sort of thing before it fully develops. And it's really cool. Like, it's quite bold to share that with someone. Like,
absolutely.
I'm quite bashful. Like I normally don't even share that sort of stuff with like the other guys in the band until I'm like very
ready.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, suppose if you hadn't done that, I've like gone to like play a riff that I've got like on my phone, and then I've accidentally played like a vocal idea that's really embarrassing or something. That's just
singing
going,
in the shower, like
that I'm never going to be able to decipher. Yeah,
but yeah, let's move on to. I mean, let's talk about that fucking Tank.
Yeah,
because that's a fucking fantastic band.
I mean, I don't even know if they've properly.
They are on some form of hiatus. Well, I think their thing is 2003 to question mark. But I know that they both have their own little projects and things. but I guess they still fit into this scene in the more left field math rock side to it. Some of the bands, like you said, you got Forward Russia, which would all intents and purposes a math rock band from time to time. But
there's like in Leeds, like when I first came to Leeds, maybe not so much anymore, but there's like a massive DIY scene where there's like loads of noise rock bands that are putting on their own gigs or their own gigs in weird places and getting other bands, like a community of bands from like, you know, around Europe or whatever, that would all be into this like noise rock DIY sort of scene, mm-hmm. making like zines. There's like a zine called Cops and Robbers that used to have like all the listings for these bands and stuff.
Yeah.
And that fucking tank were like one of those bands that were like quite like prominent in that sort of like scene, but it also spilt into like, it wasn't, I don't know, I think like the DIY scene was like a little bit kind of cliquey in places, but Tank had just, they kind of went outside of that and they'd just kind of like play whatever. It was more like a social experiment. Like, you know, you were saying you saw him supporting Foals.
Yeah.
And I think like, even though Horses sound completely different to him, we were kind of inspired by them because we were just like, these guys are just like up for like trying stuff out. And like,
yeah, they'll just get experimental this
like offer and they're like, yeah. And they'll get this offer and just be like, all right, we'll fucking see how that works out. Mm. You know, the same with Horses. Like we've ended up like supporting like Muse and like Sabian and shit. Mainly out of like morbid curiosity to go like, wonder what will happen if some fucking horrible, noisy, shouty band like comes on stage supporting a band that sounds nothing like him.
I think I've got a copy of that Live from the Royal Albert Hall EP. I think it was one of the first that they pulled the Pop by Horses one. I think it was the Royal Albert Hall, wasn't it? Was that with Muse?
Oh,
because it was an iTunes, or it was iTunes Festival, I think.
Oh, that was at the Roundhouse.
Roundhouse, yeah. That's the one. Yeah, I remember like my old school iPod Touch, wherever it is now. It was one of the first things I actually like got an iTunes account and bought it through that on there and listened to it.
Yeah.
I wish I was there like for something like that. But how was supporting Muse? Like, what was that like?
It was surreal. It was more like a festival, really.
I suppose it's all day and it's so big.
It was so big, and like we were like first on, and then there was like Band of Horses, Editors, maybe one more band, and then Muse. So it was like, you know, it started at like fucking 3 PM or something.
Yeah.
And then playing on the stage that was like, it just looked like a fucking weird X-Wing out of Star Wars or something.
Straight out of Matt Bellamy's brain.
Yeah, and it had this massive like catwalk runway on it with like a bit of the ends that maybe went up into the air. I can't really remember. But I remember them saying to us, like all the stage hands, they were like, whatever you do, you can't go on the catwalk. That's for like later, it's not safe and whatever. And I was like, yeah, no worries. And then
I can see where this is going already.
Yeah, and then like about 30 seconds into like the first song, I was like so fucking buzzing that I just ran straight down it with my guitar. My lead weren't big enough, so it like
fish-hooked
me back. And like my guitar almost came off and then just like fucking threw it. It all went to shit. But like it was just really funny. Like we just like absolutely went nuts on this spaceship for 20 minutes.
Amazing. I say it's weird, like you're the second person I know whose band has supported Muse, and I still think I'm actually the third person. It's really strange that all these bands that I know and I love then get to support the world, at one point the biggest band in the world. Like there was nowhere they could go that they didn't sell tens of thousands of tickets and things. So the guys from All Us on Drugs, All Us in Love supported them in Poland, and The Computers supported them as well over in Italy.
Well, it's weird because our management that we had at the time, like, well, at the beginning of Horses, called Brontone, managed Muse. So like,
okay, so it was like a tie-in little thing with that.
So I think maybe one of our managers were like trying to convince him. They were like, we've got this new band if you want to check them out. And then maybe they just run out of other bands or something, but we ended up doing it. But I don't know. I think like Alex Wall is his name. Like, I think he's always been into like smaller bands as well. He's always been like checking stuff out. And like with us, they totally took a chance on like a band that were like totally out of their comfort zone or whatever. They must have saw something in us. But like, I think he's kind of like done that keep like constantly. So like maybe with like All Us on Drugs and stuff, it might have something to do with him going like, oh, I've kind of heard this name
floating around, like let's give them a go and stuff. I admire that, because managers and agents stuff don't have to do that, let's be honest, because they could
well
quite
there
easily...
is a lot of back scratching and shit as well,
absolutely, like. But without that, I guess, like, well, I suppose you don't get experiences to talk about like that. I would, no one really gets experiences to talk about like that. I mean, I've tried talking to Jason and Jamalki from All Us and Drugs about the Muse thing, and they've been like, it's just so weird that we can't really talk about it. There's no like proper words for something like that for a band who, I mean, I think they supported my band at the Flapper like 3 months before they went and supported Muse. And I was like, in my head, I was like, why did I do it that way around? Like, what the fuck did I think I was at the time? But not in a bad way. Like, I was just like, these guys are excellent. Like, they're a really good bunch of lads. And now they're going to go and support Muse in Poland. I need to sort of reel my neck in a little bit.
Well, it was like goddamn supporting like Foo Fighters and stuff as well. Yeah.
We had a good chat about that. Cause I did my last bit at the end, if anyone hasn't listened to it with Tom, was to go, what's Dave Grohl like? And then his face lit up and he was like, he's fucking lovely. I was like, I'm so glad you said that. Cause I part of me wanted him to say, didn't, you know, he's not like he is on the telly and stuff, but he said he was lovely.
I still kind of think like maybe he is like a bit of a cunt, but that's only like the cynical side of me. But I've met him briefly at Leeds Fest.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you open them? Was that when you opened the main stage?
Yeah,
was it that
one?
Yeah.
And it was lovely. Like, you know, just seemed dead chatty. And he seemed like he was just kind of wandering around. And it wasn't borrowed time. Like, you'd start chatting to him, and it's like, yeah, right, I've got the time to shoot.
That's
the
exactly what
it.
Tom said. He said he was like, you just start chatting to him. And he said Tom went over. I mean, we both know Tom. Tom's not the tallest man in the world, and Dave Grohl is quite a tall man. And Tom just said he went over there and just put his arm around him and just had a chat with him. Like Tom put his arm around Dave, which is a very strange thing to do, but you know, you've got to put a power play in that situation, like that. I guess. Like, yeah. And he was like, it wasn't, like you said, borrowed time. It was just having a conversation with another dude about music. And he had a chat with Ash about his dungarees. So apparently like that made Ash really happy in the whole thing as well.
Yeah.
Well, we're on Dave Grohl, then. Shall we, let's quickly talk about Nirvana. I know it's sort of a kind of a cliche band to talk about in this situation here, but they are so influential, and I don't really think people realize that the first time someone hears Nirvana does change their life a lot.
If I hadn't got into Nirvana at like an early age, I don't think I'd be the same person. Do you know what I mean? It's so important to like who I am now. Even if I don't listen to him all the time, There's that, they're that first band. They're like my first love sort of thing. So, but I almost got to see him, which is really weird.
When would that have been? 90?
Well, yeah,
95, yeah.
Yeah.
Showing your age there, Tom.
I know, yeah. I know, I shouldn't be saying this. But my parents are like really into music and stuff. Like, you know, they went to see like Bowie play like Birmingham Town Hall when he was doing Ziggy Stardust, and they saw Queen in like a little shitty bar and stuff like that. So like my dad got like used to play stuff in the car all the time. And I remember him getting me into Nirvana when I was like still at primary school.
Mm-hmm.
I was like 10 or 11 or something. And I'd just be like listening to like Nevermind and In Utero and like, you know, singing all the wrong words and like, but like
feeling it was, like properly.
Yeah, it was like just like in my head, like kind of that made me want to play guitar, you know, want to do everything.
Mm. For a lot of people, like listening, hearing Smells Like Teen Spirit for the first time was a lot of people all putting Kerrang! TV on and you know.
Yeah, yeah, it's still kind of like kept going.
For me, it was the first time I heard You Know You're Right.
And that was the one that came out years later, wasn't it?
Like, yeah, and it came out on a Greatest Hits one. As much as people despise Greatest Hits records, I love it when they stick a track on there that, like, I think the Red Hot Chili Peppers did it as well, where they just put a new song. I say a new song, but a song that's not been released down there, and you go, oh, there's something new to discover from a band that have been out forever that you may not have discovered.
Which is nuts, isn't it? Like, they did it with, there was like a Beatles track as well, weren't there? Well, there's always like bits of Beatles stuff that comes out, but there was that one in the 90s or like late 90s that was called Free as a Bird. Mm-hmm. And it was like the same sort of thing to that Nirvana. Is it You Know You're Right?
Yeah.
Where like they probably hadn't got like a fully finished version of the song. So they've like comped all these like together, little bits together. Yeah, like a weird jigsaw. But Nirvana, like, they were like that band where I used to fall asleep listening to, I'd have like these shitty headphones on a Walkman and I'd fall asleep listening to Nirvana, like sort of manifesting like one day, like in my head, I'd be like thinking I was in the band. Like I'd be listening to the music, but imagining I was playing it and stuff, which is really weird.
And you got there. Like,
yeah.
Not a lot of people, I mean, say, everyone wants to be a rock star, or everyone wants to be a musician, or everyone wants to be in a band, or however they want to word it and stuff. And, you know, it takes balls to do it, for starters. Everyone's got the imagination to want to be an astronaut and stuff like that. But let's be honest, it's not the most realistic thing in the world. But it also takes a lot of balls to be open with music. Is a very open book for people as well. And it takes a lot of, you should take a lot of credit, I guess, for, you know, living your dream, I guess.
Yeah, that's it. You just sort of, I don't know, even if it means that you're like broke as fuck or whatever, it's like
part and parcel, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of like manifesting and being like, I want to be doing this and I'll try and do it the best I can, however I can. Like, I need to just figure it out. Like, yeah. So yeah, I've got a lot of love for Nirvana and a lot to like thank him for, really, I guess. But yeah, almost got to see him once because my dad had tickets and he was going to take me and him to go and see him. It was at like the Aston Villa grounds because by that point they were doing like arenas and shit.
Yeah.
And then I remember like being at like this kid's party or something, or like friend of a friend's, like, you know, your fake uncles or whatever.
Yeah.
The funcles. And me and my dad saw on like on BBC One, or like on the news, like about Kurt Cobain's suicide, and we were both just like devastated. But I was like fucking 10 or 11 or something, which is really
so
weird.
Hard to compute. Like,
yeah,
especially like if you said that you basically immersed yourself at that. I mean, that's a young age to be getting into music. Like, enjoying music is one thing, but actually absorbing music and surround yourself by it. It's a really young age to be doing that as well. And someone's probably going to come out and go, I was playing guitar at the age of 6 years old, and are you experiencing the first album and stuff? And like, but I mean, that must be such a hard thing to take in and then be like, oh, I was going to go and see that person. That person was going to be in front of me doing they do. And I was going to, yeah, man.
That would have been my first gig.
What was your first gig then, if you can remember?
It was like about a year after that or something. It was going to be Green Day. And then I think my dad got worried that it might have been a bit too punk.
because how wrong he was.
Because like back then it was like really early days with like Dookie, where it was probably like a bit fucking...
A bit much for a 12-year-old.
Spitting into each other's mouths and shit. I don't know. But yeah, the first gig was Presidents of the USA.
Oh, amazing. Where was that?
Wolverhampton, Wolfram Civic. Or Civic.
Wolfram or Civic. The big one. I think the big one's a Civic, isn't it? Wolfram's the... I say the small one. I think it was still about 400 or 500.
Maybe it was... No, it was Wolfram, yeah. It was the smaller one. And Cooler Shaker supported him.
Oh, man.
So they were the first band I saw, yeah.
The first band I ever saw was... Well, I went to see Motorhead when I was 13, And
that was your first band?
The first technically the first band I saw was, it was either Sepultura, it was either Sepultura or In Flames. And I was 13 years old because they were the tour support for this Motorhead gig.
What?
Yeah, I don't think my hearing has ever recovered from that.
Oh my God.
Even to this day, yeah. I don't quite understand In Flames, but I don't think many people do. So.
No.
Bit too
really.
Goblin rock for me, but yeah.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's like mythical rock in it.
And just shouty, I mean, we all love our shouty music, let's both be honest, but it's a bit too much, especially for 13-year-old me, when my favourite band at the time was the Red Hot Chili Peppers, so it's sort of one extreme to the other.
Yeah. You were more into the ooh, ba ba da da ba chi ba da ba di ba.
I like not being able to understand the words that they're saying, even though he's saying words, then not being able to understand because I can't hear what the words are being said, but yeah.
Yeah, or be like, or you're just like, Anthony Kiedis isn't actually singing words, so it's all right.
He's a beat poet, guys. He's a beat poet.
Yeah, it's easier to sing along with. Nang, ning, nang, no, nang, nang, nang.
I'll quickly move on. Like, just moving on from bands. Obviously, we've talked about the driver and everyone. Just want to quickly bring up a couple of venues that you popped on this list here, because obviously, with a lot of venues struggling or closing over the last year or so, either pandemic or none, not, you know, not to do with that. It's always nice to shine a light on them, especially if you've played some shows at these places as well, so they mean more to you than, you know, just the odd person who, like I said, alcoholic prop up the bar.
Yeah, totally.
One that really sort of, there's two actually that stuck out to me. One was The Cockpit in Leeds, which I only ever been to Leeds once and never got the chance to go. I think it had closed before I got up there, but talk to me a little bit about that. Did that have like a big influence on you playing, or was it just somewhere that you went and met people at and saw some crazy shows?
A bit of everything, really. I mean, I remember going to uni at Leeds when I was like picking my decisions of where to go.
Mm-hmm.
I remember like looking up stuff about Leeds and like venues straight away, and I saw The Cockpit and saw like what bands had played there and stuff. And I'd seen that before I'd even like looked at what like Leeds was actually like. So I was just like, yeah, that venue looks
fucking
amazing.
You already had your heart set on music, didn't you, before anything else? That yeah, always yeah. came first.
Yeah, totally. But yeah, it's quite a weird little, have you ever been there?
No, like I said, I didn't get the chance to go, unfortunately.
So it's like under like the railway arches. So there's like two rooms that come off it, one smaller than the other, that's like the second stage. But they're just like, it's like a bomb shelter. It's like a semicircle with like a corrugated roof and all noise and everything just bounces off it. You basically feel like you're in like a wind tunnel, just whatever band it is, you're just getting blasted by
the noise, like,
and like even weird like acoustic sonic things where you'd clap and you'd hear it like
all around
and resonating
places.
Off the ceiling around you and stuff. It was bizarre.
Steve Albini would love that.
Yeah, he'd be like, he'd have a total fucking field day with that. But yeah, like first time I went there, I saw Sparta, which brings us back to
gym
driving. And Linz was also at that gig. My partner, it's in Magic Mountain, but we didn't even know each other at the time. Mm-hmm. It was like the first week of uni or something. Seen like Death From Above playing in both rooms. I saw him playing in like the second room, which is tiny, which was absolutely insane. Like I couldn't hear for about a week after that. I was just like, how the fuck are two people making this much noise?
I love watching their rig rundowns, and Jess is just like, this was before obviously he started using a few guitar pedals and stuff. He goes, yeah, it's just all gain. It's just gain and volume. That's all it is.
It's just from crapped out amps that like are just about held together. Like he'd play his synth through it after like playing the bass, he'd switch to that and it sounded exactly the same because it's just going
like
but yeah, saw Blood Brothers there, that are like another fucking insane band, in like the middle room. Metric, Block Party, just like LCD Sound System, just so many like amazing bands. You know when you catch that band at like the sweet spot,
the
where
peak,
it's like,
yeah,
where it's just before like everyone's clocking who they are,
mm-hmm,
but they've got to a certain amount, you know, a certain level where they're like on it.
Yeah. where you're like, oh, they're too big for this venue. This venue is like, from here, it's going to get even bigger. So you're at like a proper special moment in their career.
It's like a best kept secret sort of thing. But yeah, like seeing so many bands at the Cockpit where it's like, shit, I'm going to see them. I'm going to want to see them next year. And I won't be able to even pay for it, afford a ticket.
You have to watch them with a pair of binoculars from the back of an arena somewhere.
Yeah, getting a nosebleed in like the fucking top seats.
Are they down there? I don't even know.
Yeah. Realize you've just been staring at like a putrid dish with ants on it for like the past half an hour.
It's just the same thing. It's just, who knows? But yeah, another venue on this list, and this is because it's the only venue someone's brought up that's not actually in the UK, and it's Molotov in Hamburg. I've been to Hamburg once. I went to see Idols there with a few friends, and they were playing in like an old art warehouse thing right at the edge of the Reeperbahn. And I didn't actually get to go into it. It was like a fleeting visit, basically. And I've got this picture in my head of what the Reeperbahn's like without actually knowing what it's like. But yeah, let me know. It's so weird.
Reeperbahn's just fucking bizarre. Like, you think like Amsterdam might be a bit seedy with like the red light district and stuff, but Hamburg's like next level. Is like just bizarre, but like really beautiful in places as well. There's some like really like the like some of the quarters are really nice in there, and then you've got like the docks, like the harbour side and shit. But yeah, like the Reeperbahn's just these like really tacky neon lights, and there's like sex shops everywhere, but then like seedy little like venues and like hidden like bars and stuff, and it all just feels like naughty and like weird and like on the like edge.
I shouldn't be here, just don't tell my mum I went here like that.
It's like a porno Euro Disney or something. But like Molotov was like obviously on the Reeperbahn, but it's like you go down these like little like tiny stairs, and it was really small, but it just had something about it. Do you know what I mean? Where there's like, it's kind of like the 100 Club in London or whatever. It's like just legendary.
Yeah.
And we played like Reeperbahn Festival. We played there with like Future Left and Dan Aykroyd and a few other bands I can't remember. But like, yeah, that was really cool. Just tiny little sweaty dungeon in this weird area. But yeah, just great.
So those are the best type of venues, in my opinion. They're sort of ones that you have to discover them. And then when you're there, you're like, this place has got some of the wildest character that, you know, you can't really properly describe it without being there. And unfortunately, I was not going to be able to get the chance to go. So you've made me sad there. But
yeah, well, Molotov is, I think it's had like a few different forms. Like the people behind it are still, they've got a different venue in a different location, but it's probably still got, you know, the same ethos behind it and stuff, but
it's slightly more upmarket.
It's not the OG like little dungeon that started.
You're such a venue hipster, Tom.
Yeah, I know.
I was there before it was another place, but yeah.
Yeah. I've got the t-shirt, man.
And let's just talk about, I think this would be the biggest venue on this list. Is the Astoria in London.
Yeah.
Again, another venue I've not had a chance to go to. I didn't get to go out much in my younger years. Give us some stories about the Astoria then.
Full circle, bringing it back to like the Volpine days when we supported Eagles of Death Metal, when we didn't have a fucking clue what we were doing, driving around in a van that we called the Space Ambulance, because it was just this like piece of shit van with a disabled like wheelchair access.
I had a hydraulic lift on the back.
In the back, yeah, which was pretty handy for gear, but then the whole thing guzzled gallons of petrol in like minutes. It was like so shit. But on that tour, our last gig was at London Astoria, and it was like one of the first times we played London as well, so it was like fucking insane. I remember like seeing like Bobby Gillespie from like Primal Scream like sat on like the front row balcony and shit. Like it was just like
really just sat there shaking his head.
Yeah, it's just shit. But yeah, it was really bizarre. And I just remember like walking on stage, and there was no lights on anything. And then all of a sudden the floodlights came on, like the, you know,
for the crowd lights, yeah.
Lights. And like just seeing like a balcony, like double tier sort of like venue. And it was like an old theater that had basically gone to shit. It was like, it was like if cyberpunks had taken over a beautiful opera theater or something.
And like, we're making this our own. We're going to sleep in here. We're going to live in here.
Yeah. It was like, you know, when you see like shit 80s post-apocalyptic films where there's just like neon spray paint everywhere and like loads of 12 homeless
monkeys,
people.
Isn't it? Isn't it like
a warming their hands over like bins
garbage cans outside?
It was kind of like somebody had done like a post-apocalyptic makeover on an opera theater or something. But yeah, I like got to play that, which was fucking amazing. And it was just like, you know, it's just lodged in my memory. Like that was a moment that happened. And then I remember a few years later, it ended up getting like knocked down and turned into flats and like fucking gentrified, like, you know.
Yeah. More unaffordable housing. And
yeah, three quarters of London is, you know, that's the way it sort of goes.
Yeah.
Which kind of bummed me out and stuff. But then, you know, new places pop up and stuff, don't they? Like everything's always like evolving, like with like bands and venues and whatever. But I remember supporting a band, supporting Le Savvy Fav at Heaven, which are like another one of my favorite bands that are now split up.
You did a live album from Heaven, didn't you?
Yeah, we did like later on, yeah, but it weren't that one.
It's on the Blood Tour, I think that one was, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And we played supporting Le Savvy Fav, and I remember like going outside for a cig in this like weird area, weird part of the venue, and I saw the London Astoria sign. So even though it had got knocked down,
they still whoever
owned Heaven had kept the sign.
That's amazing.
And like, it was just in like the fucking corridor where like you load your gear in and stuff. And all throughout the night, I was just like sizing it up. I was like, shit, will that fit in the van?
How big's
like,
the van?
I really wanted to nick it. I didn't in the end. I don't know what's happened to it, but it was like so weird seeing this like smoggy, you know, like pollution stained London Astoria, you know, lit
proper
up.
Proper piece of history, like.
Logo, yeah,
that's amazing.
That's nuts. I don't know what the fuck I'd have done with it if I'd have stolen it, though.
I mean, I think it would have been up on your wall in your room you're in now, but the looks of it,
I'd have to put it on the front of my house or something.
Yeah, you get people rocking up to the London Astoria up in Leeds going, this isn't how it looks like in the pictures.
Yeah, just add it on Google Maps, just like, who's playing here?
Get a blue plaque just underneath it as well.
Yeah, yeah,
stolen by Tom Hudson.
Yeah, that would have been a total claim to fame, wouldn't it?
Tom, I'm going to leave it there because I feel like, again, I say this to everyone, we could just speak for hours and hours and hours about all these bands and things. And I hope, obviously, I'd love to get you back on again in a couple of years' time, whenever this is still going on and everything. But I said before, if I say thank you to you too much, you could say no thank you. But it's the first time I said thank you. I really, really appreciate your time and all your music, and good luck with everything that you do. I'll hopefully see you at a show. Man.
It's a total pleasure. Like, you know,
I love a good nostalgia trip, eh?
Yeah. Well, the problem is you asking me to do it is the fact that I've been around for fucking ages. So there's a lot of bands that are split up and a lot of stories.
So this is a very selfish thing of me, because like I said, I've been a big fan for a very long time, and I genuinely do. I admire you a lot, and I really appreciate your time. So thank you very much.
Oh, cheers, Rich. Yeah. Same to you. Good luck with everything.
Thank you.